The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Running a medical practice is tough. You're constantly juggling issues with compliance, finances, operations, and staffing. But who's helping you? The Medical Group Management Association gives healthcare leaders the tools, training, and connections for success. Gain expert resources, industry savings, and a network of professionals just like you. Join now and get the Principles of Practice Management training free. Join at mgma.com/membership. That's mgma.com/membership.
How many small actions does it take to create a horrific accident? How many people had to make just the right or wrong decision in order to create the exact conditions for disaster? When unspeakable tragedy happens, is it possible to untangle all the threads that wove it together? Welcome to Strange and Unexplained with me, Daisy Egan. I once had a friend who was obsessed with plane crashes. She read up on every detail of any crash she could get her hands on. She said it was because she had a terrible fear of flying, and reading about crashes somehow helped her feel some sense of control over them. For me, it's the opposite. The less I know about anything, the better. I was much happier before I learned about microplastics, for example. Now, every time I see food come into contact with any plastic, all I can think about are the forever chemicals coursing through my bloodstream, waiting to become cancer. I've said it before, and I'll say it again. It is exhausting to live in my brain. Up until I started doing this show, my fear of flying was pretty much nil. But then there were the ghost flights, the hijacked planes, and now today's episode that have all definitely made me think twice about ever again getting in a multi-ton metal tube that magically floats on air. Turns out, though, the magical flying machine doesn't even have to be magically floating in the air in order to be a death trap. Who knew the tarmac could be so dangerous? Just after noon on March 27, 1977, an employee with the Gran Canaria Airport in Tenerife, Spain, answered the phone and heard a member of the separatist group Canary Islands Independence Movement say there were bombs planted in the airport. The airport was evacuated and all flights scheduled to land were diverted. And then, a little after 1 p.m., a bomb exploded outside a florist shop in one of the terminals, injuring 8 people. But as far as airport officials understood, that was just one of multiple bombs planted around the airport. So the threat was not over. I will say this, considering the airport had been evacuated and the bomb was left in an unattended suitcase, I'm not sure why it wasn't found before it went off. Or maybe it was and they just hadn't had time to deactivate it or whatever. I don't know. And it doesn't matter. Everyone traveling through the largest airport on the Canary Islands that day was still in for a long wait as officials searched for the remaining bombs. The planes circling above were diverted to Los Rodeos, the nearest regional airport located on a separate island just about 50 air miles away at Santa Cruz de Tenerife. Pan Am Flight 1736, piloted by an experienced Victor Grubbs, was in fact a flight chartered by Royal Cruise Lines and full of those booked on a Mediterranean cruise. The passengers, worried that the ship would sail without them, could do little as their plane now headed to Los Rodeos. Lucky for them, among those aboard the Pan Am plane were the vice president of the cruise lines, the ship's cruise director, and several travel agents that had booked the flight and the cruise package. So, the ship would definitely not set sail without the VIPs aboard. KLM Royal Dutch Airlines Flight 4805, a gigantic 747 with 248 on board, 235 passengers, 52 of whom were children, and 14 crew, was in a similar predicament. The plane had been chartered by the Holland International Tour Lines. The big deal pilot who had control of the flight had his own set of scheduling worries. Jacob Louis Veldhuizen van Zanten, the airline's chief pilot, was the most experienced the airline had. He was the guy who taught other guys how to fly these new big supersized Airbuses, ginormous machines that gobbled jet fuel, had an upstairs lounge, and 16 crew members on board. The 50-year-old pilot was so revered that his face was on many of the airline's advertising posters. He was, in fact, the director of KLM's flight safety. Van Zanten was sure he could get these people to Gran Canaria, where their own ship was waiting. He was sure he had a handle on the timing he needed to do that. He was pretty sure about most things. He was that kind of guy. You had to be if you were the pilot of an aircraft this size. You had to be decisive. You had to let your training do the work. But no matter how sure Van Zanten was, there was one thing over which he had little control. Dutch air crews could only work a certain number of hours before their boss would face severe penalties. Now, you know me, stranger, I'm all for workplace regulations. 20-hour work week? Bring it on. But the boss, when it came to airplane crews, was the pilot. So if there was a delay, the pilot could do nothing about, say, bad weather or, you know, a bomb threat, or, God forbid, bad weather and a bomb threat. The pilot could be looking at losing their license and possible jail time. That's right. The penalty a pilot could face for letting their crew work over the allotted hours was possible jail time. Dutch authorities said this was necessary to ensure the safety of passengers. Something about not wanting pilots to fly tired? I mean, okay. So every minute he sat on the tarmac at Los Rodeos waiting to be cleared to fly to Gran Canaria was a minute he lost in control of the schedule. The airport bomb at Gran Canaria had upended everything. And now there was the fog the small airport regularly had to contend with, what with its high altitude. But what the airport did not regularly have to deal with was the number of planes sitting on its tarmac diverted from Gran Canaria. The runway was small and definitely not built to accommodate so many huge planes. Pilots Van Zanten and Grubbs knew that late March day was going to be a long one. What no one knew yet was that there had only been one bomb. The airport employee who'd fielded the call from the representative of Canary Islands Independence Movement had misheard bombs, plural. So the airport remained closed while the other bombs that didn't exist were being hunted down. Later, much later, when all of it had been dissected and explained, litigated and mourned, it would be clear that if only one small thing among a hefty list of things had been different, 583 people may not have lost their lives on the tarmac that day. Instead, the tragedy would soon be known as the deadliest aviation disaster ever. It still is.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You hear that? That's the sound of Pepsi Zero Sugar, the better tasting, more refreshing Zero Sugar Cola. Listen to that endless pour. Pure refreshment. If it sounds this good, just imagine how it tastes. Oh yeah, so good. Pepsi Zero Sugar. Let your taste decide.
Who knows how many near misses we have each day. If that random stranger hadn't been there to pull me back when I ran into the street in front of a bus to retrieve a UPS box that had fallen off its handcart, I might not be telling you this story today. Who knows how many times I've dodged a bout of food poisoning because I chose to eat an entire box of mac and cheese instead of a salad laced with Listeria. And who says eating healthy is always better? If I hadn't stalled on submitting my application to the crappy university I finally graduated from, maybe I wouldn't have met my son's father. It's the sliding doors of it all, which, incidentally, that movie is highly overrated. Did you know that Seth MacFarlane was supposed to be on one of the planes that hit the World Trade Center on September 11th, 2001? But because he was hungover and his travel agent gave him the wrong departure time, he missed the plane? Perhaps a few less drinks and a competent travel agent would mean we'd all be without American Dad and the Family Guy. Take that how you will. Anyway. In 1977, flying was still considered quite the occasion, something worthy of dressing up for, still kind of special and still kind of orderly and pleasant and thrilling. This was before we all had to get used to racing to find a seat on Southwest and be asked to pay extra to actually take clothes on vacation. One thing that was the same, however, was airlines' fun habit of overbooking their flights. If there are 200 seats on the plane, sell 220 tickets. Shh, don't worry, it'll be great. So with the Pan Am flight already having been delayed an hour in Los Angeles before picking up more passengers in New York, some surely disgruntled ticketed passengers couldn't get on and had to figure out another way to make it to their cruise out of the Canary Islands. Those folks had no way of knowing then how lucky they were. Pan Am Flight 1736 was a Boeing 747-121. The plane was 230 feet long. Its wingspan was 211 feet. The tail reached twice that height, and with that second floor lounge, the whole thing was not terribly fuel efficient. It carried 60,000 gallons of jet fuel. This will be important later on. The trip to the Grand Canary Islands from New York was 12 hours, but once you got there, you were at your first posh touristy destination, a Spanish archipelago off the coast of northwestern Africa, created out of volcanic lava flows, which had sculpted pristine black and white beaches that rest under towering palms. But in the 1970s, there was trouble in paradise. A certain rebel contingent was trying hard to gain the island's independence from Spain and join a loosely based organization of African countries. They rallied that this kind of colonialism was very last century and the islands wanted better. They lobbied for a publicly owned water supply and more attention to the residents there who were chronically unemployed. Of course, they did more than lobby. Trying to get the attention of the colonial powers that were, they chose that day to send a message by way of a bomb in an unattended suitcase. After the airport employee received the misheard bomb threat, all inbound flights were instructed to circle the airport, with passengers being told little about what was going on in the airport just below. Circling as well, a few thousand feet below the Pan Am flight, was the KLM flight, also awaiting further instructions. After a small delay, both were told to proceed to Los Rodeos Airport in Tenerife and wait for further word. The tarmac at Los Rodeos, with the diversions, was now tasked with servicing 50 more planes than its usual load. This meant that planes were parked on the taxiway usually reserved for aircraft about to turn on to the sole runway before takeoff. As most accounts of the day later note, this wasn't proving too large a problem for the busy air traffic controllers on duty, because most of the planes were small and could maneuver around the larger ones to get to the runway when the okay to return to Gran Canaria was given. Ever mindful about time, KLM's Van Santen did some math. He had enough fuel to get back to Amsterdam, but who knew if he would still be burning fuel, waiting, or circling? It was proving to be a longer delay than the KLM pilot had figured. At around 4 that afternoon, he decided he could save time at Gran Canaria by refueling his plane while it sat on the Tenerife tarmac. He assumed the process would take about a half an hour. He radioed the tower. Refueling began, but it was going slow. Then, as described in Collision on Tenerife by John Ziemek, a few minutes into the process, word came that Gran Canaria Airport was now open and planes could return to disembark their passengers and board those waiting to get on for return flights away from Gran Canaria. Van Santen must have been pissed. He was stuck. Pan Am's pilot Grubbs, of course, would have loved to get the heck out of there, but he could not manage to get his jumbo jet around the KLM plane, which was blocking his way. According to Ziemek, quote, they needed a lot of room, about 140 feet, allowing for the wheels and the wing on one side. Grubbs had no intention of sitting around this airport any longer than he had to. Besides, he could see for himself that the weather was getting worse, end quote. Grubbs even had his flight crew climb out of the jet and manually measure the distance between the two planes to see if he could squeak by. Listen, I have to say that if I had been sitting on that plane and noticed the flight attendants out there with a measuring tape, I would have insisted on deboarding and getting a flight out any other time on any other plane. Either that, or I would be insisting on a boatload of complimentary tiny liquor bottles. The word from his officers was that they needed 20 more feet to get around the big-ass jet from the Netherlands. There was no choice but to wait for the other plane to finish refueling. By now, the two airplanes and the traffic controllers were on the same radio frequency, so they could hear what the other one was doing and the instructions being given to each, which should have helped to avoid any confusion. It would, instead, multiply it.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong. The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Because of all that fog, the controllers at Los Rodeos could not see what was happening on the taxiways or on the runway where they were directing traffic. Which seems odd to me. Why even bother to have a control tower if your airport is shrouded in fog most of the time? Not really, but kinda. That meant they had to trust what the pilots were telling them about where they were on the runway. When Grubbs, in the Pan Am plane, asked KLM's Van Zanten how much longer it would take to refuel, he regrettably answered, 45 minutes. Van Zanten did the math. He knew that the crew had begun their day at 9 a.m. in Amsterdam. If he could get off the ground at Tenerife by 5, he could get to Gran Canaria and turn the passengers in an hour and take off before he'd be required to cancel the outgoing flight and ground the crew. He'd already called the higher-ups in Amsterdam to let them know what was happening and to assure them he knew the rules about flight crew hours, but honestly, what the hell could he do at that point? By 4:45, both pilots had impressed upon the air traffic controller their desire to get going. There were still a lot of planes on the taxiway, so they were both told to taxi along the runway to get into position for takeoff. KLM was first to move, followed by the Pan Am jet. The flight ahead was scheduled to take no more than 25 minutes, wheels up to wheels down. The KLM flight was cleared to basically backtrack down the runway, then do a 180 to position the plane at the end of the runway with the full extent of the runway in front of them and wait for further instructions. Grubbs of Pan Am was told to do the same, except that he was to exit the runway by way of a little intersection that would put him back on the taxiway until it was his turn. The Pan Am's first officer, Richard Bragg, unfamiliar with the airport runway at Tenerife, checked a schematic of the whole setup and made a mental note about where to have his pilot turn out. According to the officers of the Pan Am plane, Pan Am was told to roll down the runway and to turn right at the third intersection. They were told to report to both the controllers and to KLM when they had left the runway. At 5:05 and 44 seconds, one of the KLM crew reported they were at the end of the runway and made the turn and were ready for takeoff. The KLM crew repeated the instructions, adding, "We are now at takeoff." The controller then issued directions to the KLM crew about what they were supposed to do post-takeoff, specifically the proper heading and airspeed needed to turn their plane to return to Gran Canaria. According to later investigations, which synchronized the audio tapes with the black box recorders of mechanical changes in the cockpit, Van Zanten then released his brakes and pushed his throttle forward. The tower was aware that Pan Am was still taxiing and so had not reported that it had turned right to get off the runway, clearing the runway, because of course Pan Am had not made the turn yet and the runway was not clear. Meanwhile, in the Pan Am plane, the third exit, there were four, was either missed due to fog or purposely excluded because that turn would have required not a 45-degree angle veer for the huge jet, but a 148-degree angle turn, which the behemoth could not have made in that limited space. The tower, not understanding that the KLM plane was gaining speed, now told KLM, "Okay, stand by for takeoff, I will call you." At the exact same time, the Pan Am crew clicked on its transmitter to say, "No, we're still taxiing down the runway," and identified itself with its call sign, Clipper 1736. Because of the crosstalk on the radio, the audio on both ends emitted a loud shrieking that lasted 3.74 seconds. All the KLM crew appeared to hear was okay. The traffic controller, having missed the "no, we're still on the runway," said, "Papa Alpha 1736, report runway clear." However, a later report revealed that Papa Alpha 1736 had never before, nor would ever again, be used as a call sign for the Pan Am flight. The correct call sign was Clipper 1736. Which, understandably, may have added to the already mounting miscommunication happening. Why the tower chose to use their own special, unique, fun time nickname for the plane instead of the correct one, I don't know. At any rate, the first officer of the Pan Am crew responded, "Okay, we'll report when clear." The KLM's flight engineer heard that and asked those in the cockpit, "Is he not clear then?" Captain Van Zanten gave a hearty, "Oh yeah," something only the cockpit could hear. Later, investigators listened intently to the "yeah." It was uttered 0.7 seconds before the controller had finished his instructions. That would, probably rightly, mark Van Zanten as impatient. Dangerously so. Now the die was cast. The lights on the KLM were becoming marginally visible to the Pan Am crew only a second later as the KLM jumbo jet was approaching them at 200 miles per hour. The KLM crew then saw the Pan Am jet on the runway as well, and Van Zanten began to violently try to lift his jet up and over it. In doing so, he dragged the plane's tail into the runway for about 65 feet. The Pan Am crew had simultaneously applied full power and had tried to make a hard right to get out of the way and onto the grass nearby. The KLM did not rise far enough, though, and so, instead of clearing the Pan Am plane, it scraped the top off the Pan Am plane, shearing the whole top lounge area off. First Officer Bragg would later report to the Canadian documentary Mayday, the Tenerife Airport Disaster, that it was like a knife or can opener had just peeled off the metal on top of the plane. Inside the Pan Am jet, the crew reported later that they all instinctively had ducked. Bragg said that was when he knew it was time to leave, with all cockpit crew exiting the aircraft through a hole the collision had made on the side. They each then took a 45-foot drop onto the concrete runway before rolling onto the ground and scrambling away as fast as possible. They took no notice then of broken limbs or cuts or burns. They just hastened to clear themselves of the spreading debris. I can't help but wonder if they tried to save any of the passengers. It doesn't sound like they did. I'm sure they were terrified for their lives, but also, like, isn't assisting passengers in the event of an emergency part of the job title? at exactly 5:06, 49 and 3/100ths of a second, two of the world's most monstrous airplanes collided with 644 people aboard. Van Zanten's last words were, "Oh God, verdomme," or as translated into English, "Oh God damn." After the KLM jet struggled to become airborne and sheared off the top of the Pan Am plane, as reported in tailstrike.com, which provides a complete cockpit voice recorder transcript of the incident, quote, "The KLM aircraft flew on and crashed out of control 150 meters further on, sliding another 300 meters, bursting into flame," end quote. By now, the flames were burning 200 feet high. The KLM had just taken on a full load of jet fuel, which was now feeding the conflagration. No one from the KLM flight would survive. As for the Pan Am flight, of the 248 on the plane, 61 managed to get themselves out of the plane, albeit with injuries that ranged from minor to life-threatening. The chaos aboard the plane, painstakingly documented in ZMX Collision on Tenerife, was and is heartbreaking, mostly because he shows how some people died because the shock of it had rendered them unable to help themselves. Their minds were just unable to adjust fast enough to put together a coherent plan of escape. These folks were mostly in the middle and forward parts of the plane. The people in the rear of the Pan Am plane had little chance. It was complete destruction from row 40 back. Meanwhile, the air traffic control tower had no idea that any of this was going on down on their runway. The only indication the tower had that something catastrophic had occurred was when they saw a flash and an intense light coming from somewhere on the runway. The fog had obscured it all from view. A man on board the Pan Am flight had survived with his camera to take some pictures from the earliest moments. They would be used heavily in the long road ahead to untangle what happened. The next morning, air crash investigation crews from Spain, the Netherlands, and the United States were on site. The planes were still burning. A thorough analysis took 21 months. A final report on the disaster was filed by the Spanish Undersecretary of State for Civil Aviation in December 1978. It would note Van Zanten's preoccupation with making his way back to Amsterdam in time to avoid any kind of punishment. It also noted that this flight was the first he had made in 3 months, having been occupied as a flight instructor to the KLM pilots new to the 747, which he had not actually flown. What is noteworthy there is that in simulators, there is no air traffic controller telling pilots what to do. The man who is directing the training exercise, read that Van Zanten, does the controlling. He was the one who gave clearance to take off to his practicing pilots. Why is this important? Because he became used to being the decider. And he decided on March 27, 1977, to move without clearance to do so. To be clear, he didn't know he didn't have clearance. It's not like he was going to take off while another aircraft was sitting on the tarmac in front of him, but he definitely didn't do enough to be sure the runway was clear. But really, there were so many small things that piled up on top of each other that led to this awful tragedy. So many chances of fate and seemingly tiny decisions that added up to a mess.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong. The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
It's usually impossible to parse out when and where exactly a defining moment in any event occurred. With the crash at Tenerife Airport on March 27th of 1977, there are so many identifiable forks in the road. To heavily paraphrase Ziemek as he ticked off the what-ifs, if the Pan Am plane had not been delayed in L.A., it would not have been delayed in leaving New York, and it would have arrived before the KLM plane, thus would have been put in front of that plane in their mutual redirect to Tenerife. If the separatist group had chosen another locale at another time or on another day for their bomb stunt, neither of the planes involved would have had to be diverted to Tenerife. If the person who answered the call heard bomb singular instead of bombs plural, it's possible the concern after the blast would have shortened the timeline on that day. If the two jets had been sitting on a wider taxiway, Pan Am could have slipped past the KLM jet and been on its merry way. If Van Zanten hadn't figured he'd beat the clock by refueling, or if he had decided earlier in the day to begin refueling, the two planes might have proceeded to take off earlier when the weather was better and visibility vastly improved. If the Pan Am crew had objected to taxiing on a live runway and simply waited their turn, the planes would not have crossed paths. If the crews had not talked over one another, no squealing noise would have obscured the message, which came over, at best, as garbled and truncated. If the air traffic controller had not used the word okay, perhaps the KLM plane would not have begun its takeoff roll. If the Pan Am crew had taken the third exit as instructed and tried to somehow manage the difficult angle without edging onto the grass, they at least would have been out of harm's way. If Van Zanten had not been impatient or distracted or so confident he could beat the clock and stay within the lines drawn by Dutch lawmakers, he may not have rushed the takeoff. If he had just listened to his flight crew, he could have canceled the takeoff, just in case the subordinate officer was correct in assuming the Pan Am plane had not removed itself from the runway. If the weather had improved, the pilots and the controllers would have seen the runway clearance issue long before anything irreversible happened. The remains of those who died were identified by dental comparisons, medical x-rays, and personal effects. The remains of the 212 identified as Americans were returned to the United States for burial. A memorial to the 583 victims were erected 30 years after the disaster. Designed by a Dutch artist, it is located on the outskirts of the city of San Cristobal de la Laguna on the island of Tenerife. It has a view, sometimes obscured by fog, of the Los Rodeos Airport. I hate the cliché, they didn't die in vain, because, you know, they died. The almost 600 who perished never set out to teach the airline industry any lessons, and I'm sure they would have skipped that whole death thing if given a choice. Nevertheless, the world of international air travel changed radically after that, especially as concerns pilot training, strict cockpit procedures, ground communication, and tightened use of runways for anything that isn't, you know, taking off or landing. For starters, the pilot is no longer to be considered some kind of deity up there. If someone in the cockpit with only a few hours in the air spots something amiss, they can question it out loud and not be reprimanded for insubordination. This is formalized as CRM in the biz, or Crew Resource Management. It is the order of the day now in pilot education around the world. For another, language between the tower and the flight crew has been standardized. If crew members want to acknowledge instructions from the tower, they are not to say OK or Roger. They are to repeat back what they heard. Further, the word takeoff cannot be used any time during air traffic control instructions unless it is meant you can fucking take off now. Otherwise, if you are holding at the end of the runway and you think you are next and you hear ready to depart, you have to sit tight until the T word is uttered. There's more. After the calamity, the Dutch altered their overly rigid work law regarding flight crew limitations to be less punitive, more flexible, and cognizant of common sense decisions made on the fly. And the world ditched, or tried to, a ridiculous air travel staple. Before and into the 1970s, those who worked the aisles were known as stewardesses, stewards, hostesses, or hosts, and they were almost always women, and they were considered nothing more than sexy waitresses. Sure, early on in the 1960s, they had to be registered nurses. That job requirement was relaxed, but they still had to be unmarried and had to weigh in regularly to make sure they weren't getting too plump for the sexy designation. They also appeared in ads that boldly encouraged customers to fly me.
I'm Marisa. I've got nonstop flights to Miami every day. Fly me.
The union had tried to alter this sexist bullshit, but were not getting very far. Post Tenerife, they got heard. That is, flight attendants were seen as the resource they were and got respect for their ability to serve as overseers of the safety of those on the plane and not just waitresses in the sky. Forever after, they would teach safety and they would enforce it. Last but not least, academia got seriously interested in why some people survive in calamitous circumstances and some do not. More than 100 Pan Am passengers are thought to have survived the initial impact, though only half of them had the wherewithal to get out of the plane before it was consumed by fire. That means at least 50 people didn't have to perish. Some deaths can be chalked up to overwhelming shock, or maybe they'd been struck on the head or were bleeding, and those who lived to talk about it later simply didn't have time to inquire. But survivors told of passengers who would not budge, even when encouraged with offers of help. So, who lived and who didn't? I was kind of astonished to find out it was the ones who actually paid attention when the safety instructions were given and who had pinpointed their exits when they first took their seats. Astonished, of course, because most of us take those safety instructions for granted. I guess we really should be paying attention instead of trying to get in that last selfie with hashtag plane life. The other bunch who lived, like the flight crew of the Pan Am plane in this case, were those who were trained to remain calm and think clearly in a flight emergency. So researchers weren't surprised to find that those who had military training were likely to do well in these situations as well. So too, those who had EMT or police training. You know, people whose first instinct is not to be overwhelmed by their circumstances. Plane crashes are rare. According to USA Facts, a nonprofit civic group dedicated to making government data easy to understand, in 2022, 39 commercial aviation accidents occurred worldwide. In those, 158 people died. This means there was one accident every 830,000 flights. Or, if this makes more sense to you, CNN tells me that the fatality rate for air travel was 0.0003 deaths per 100 million miles traveled. It's also true that plane crashes on runways are fairly non-existent because there is ground radar almost everywhere now. Los Rodeos Airport did not have one in 1977. It got one just after the crash. Now, depending on where you get your data and what crashes they include, pilot error is the cause of between 50 and 80% of crashes. The follow-up investigations placed a significant amount of blame on Van Zanten, who did not survive the crash. KLM did not have a single large payout to survivors of their family, but incurred a lot of legal costs and compensation claim settlements. They took a reputational hit, but remain the airline which is the flag carrier of the Netherlands. In 2023, it made 30 billion euros in revenue. Pan American Airlines ceased operations in late 1991, selling off its routes to cover operating expenses. No one blamed that on the Tenerife crash. It was just bad business. A vestige of the airline will take to the skies in June 2025 with a 50-passenger, 12-day Pan Am experience around the world. Cost $65,000 per person. Anyway, last but not least, I wanted to tell you that I have two friends who are airline pilots, and while they don't talk much about their work, I remember two important things they said while we chatted over drinks. No airplane has ever fallen out of the sky because of turbulence. And sit as close to an exit row as you can. The first was comforting. The second, not so much. Still, I have not forgotten either one.
Thank you.
Next time on Strange and Unexplained. When young Aubrey Wyatt tragically chose to end her life rather than continue to endure the bullying she was experiencing both in school and from her school bullies online, the bullying didn't stop. Bad behavior seemed to spread like a virus from both sides. Strange and Unexplained is a production of Three Goose Entertainment with help from Grab Bag Collab. This episode was written and researched by Amy Wilson and me, Daisy Egan. Sound engineering by Jeff Devine, with music from Epidemic and Blue Dot Sessions. If you have an idea for an episode, head to our website, strangeandunexplainedpod.com, and fill out the contact form. I will write back. For more amazing content, join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab, where for just $5 a month, you get all the Grab Bag exclusive shows, and for $8, you get those, plus Amber Hunt's Crimes of the Centuries and Strange and Unexplained early and ad-free. Grab Bag is an all-female and non-binary-owned profit-share network where our contributors get to keep ownership of their shows. We strive to give a platform to those who might not be able to land themselves on a bigger network. Who knows? Maybe you have a podcast idea you'd like to pitch to Grab Bag. We've got live recordings, watch parties, book clubs, and more. Why there's so much going on over at Grab Bag, you'll wonder if we missed the memo on how capitalism works. Join me on Instagram at SNUPod, Daisy Egan, and Grab Bag Collab. Or head to the Facebook page to join in the conversation. If you like the show, please visit a sponsor with our unique code, give us a quick review and 5 stars, subscribe and download, and tell a friend. Stay strange.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You hear that? That's the sound of Pepsi Zero Sugar, the better tasting, more refreshing Zero Sugar Cola. Listen to that endless pour. Pure refreshment. If it sounds this good, just imagine how it tastes. Oh yeah, so good. Pepsi Zero Sugar. Let your taste decide.
Running a medical practice is complex, but you don't have to go it alone. When you join the Medical Group Management Association, you get access to an entire team of healthcare business experts, plus thousands of other members in practice management who face the same challenges as you. MGMA helps you advance in your career and helps your practice operate more efficiently and stay compliant. Join now and get exclusive access to our brand new 2025 Provider Compensation Report. Sign up today. This report is available to MGMA members only. Join today at MGMA.com.